This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
My name is Christina Vo, and I'm the co-author of My Vietnam, Your Vietnam, and The Veil Between Two Worlds.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over. Thank you so much for coming on. We have been trying to schedule this so many damn times, and here we are.
Yes, thank you, Kenneth. I'm happy to be here.
You're a super busy person. And, you know, before we start to talk about this sort of historic backdrop of how the book came together, you know, I want to know, you know, how you got to live in Vietnam many years ago.
Yeah, so it's funny, I'm actually writing little kind of snippets of my Vietnam story just on social media leading up to the book release next Tuesday. But I graduated from UNC Chapel Hill, and I started working at GlaxoSmithKline Pharmaceutical Company. And I just remember in the marketing department, it was a great job. There was a great trajectory. But I was 22, you know, fresh out of college. And I just remember thinking daily there, I can't do this as my trajectory, is my future. I can't just work at this pharmaceutical company and then, you know, eventually get a house in the suburbs of, you know, live in Raleigh, North Carolina, you know, all these things. And we were at a team meeting, the whole team, probably, I don't know, maybe 60 of us. And they asked us to share something that our colleagues didn't know. And I just blurted out, I'm going to live in Vietnam. I had no plan. But I was just listening to all of them. They were all, you know, I was probably one of the younger ones. So they were all mostly middle age. And I was like, there's no way that, because they were, you know, all of the things that they shared were all from the past, from when they were in college or when they were in a band when they were younger or when they were an athlete, nothing that was current. So I thought I just couldn't imagine myself having that life 20 years from that moment. So I actually started, you know, it was the time when we didn't have Skype. I bought calling cards at an Asian grocery store, and I started calling organizations in Vietnam, in Hanoi, public health organizations, international organizations, trying to find an internship. And I would do it every night because it was a 12-hour difference. So at night, it would be morning there, and I would call. And then I overheard somebody talking at the Starbucks. And this man was talking about his friend, Chad, who lived in Hanoi, was working for the Asia Foundation. So I called the Asia Foundation and ended up on the phone with Chad. And then there were a couple different avenues that it happened. But the executive director of Chad, of the Asia Foundation, his wife worked for UNDP. And I had also another contact through UNDP. So basically, I got an internship at UNDP because they kept hearing my name. So they offered me like a 6-month unpaid internship to go to Hanoi. So that's how my first experience.
Well, yeah. You know, this is interesting because, you know, a lot of people who are probably listening are probably wondering how, you know, they could make that transition. Cause I remember when I was young, I thought about that all the time. What is the biggest challenge when you pick up and do that after being, you know, educated, after living here in the US, and picking up and going to Vietnam? I'm sure there's a difference in back in the day, how it was many, many years ago, and then today. But I mean, the challenges might be kind of the same, right? When you're living your entire life as a young person in America and you go back to Vietnam. But what are some of the challenges you think that people will face when they do that?
I mean, I think it just depends on the, because I haven't been back in like 6 or 7 years, but don't you think it's, doesn't it feel easy in some ways to me?
Yes, for us, I think for me, it felt very easy. I agree with that. But so I mean, there's other things. I mean, you go back 6 months and you don't have money. They don't pay you. Like, how does that work?
Well, that was different because it was, 22 years ago. So everything was so
Cheap.
affordable. I mean, yet cheap. Like, I think a coffee might have been 50 cents, like between 15 and 50, very different. Renting a place, even your own place. I had an apartment on my own for a little bit, and I think that was 300 a month. So I had saved some money from the year working, and I was just gonna stay for 6 months to a year, however long I had enough money for. And then actually I stayed at that internship for 6 months and then moved to Saigon and started working for an advertising agency. And with that job, I was paid a little bit, like 500. So it was enough. That was enough for everything. I
Wow.
think in a shared house, I think there were five of us. I think our rent was 150 or something. So living off 350 was fine like back then, which is so funny to think about.
Yeah, it's insane. I think about the reasons why I sit here and the reasons why you sit there and the reasons why our stories, like so many people in our generation, second generation, come together and talk about our love for Vietnam. Recently, I was on a podcast that I did, and I talked really in support of moving to Vietnam, like it, or really supporting the life of, expats in Vietnam, Vietnamese Americans going to Vietnam. And I got a lot of pushback in the comment section, which I enjoyed. I welcome because, these are like staunch, like anti-communist, people, and they don't
Like
have.
my dad.
And I understand it. I can relate. But I think we're you and I are living in a new chapter of this sort of Vietnamese American experience where you just said that it was easy for you to go back to Vietnam, and I feel the same way, but it's not easy for, previous generation to
Yes.
do the same.
Well, because for us, I mean, even imagine at that age, at 22, 23, then we all, I mean, we can also in a shared house afford a housekeeper, right? Who becomes like,
We don't have the cultural baggage that they did.
yes. And to us, it's like, it's, well, I don't know about now, but back then it was just so much more economical to live there. And it was exciting. You were meeting all kinds of, being exposed to Vietnamese culture, but then meeting people from all over the world. It was just, and I think interestingly, that's why I think I moved to Santa Fe 3 years ago because of that same desire for change. I mean, it's very different. Santa Fe is not as exciting as Vietnam, but New Mexico, in a lot of ways, to me, feels like another country in some ways. And I think when I turned 40, I really missed who I was in my early 20s, those parts of myself. And maybe that's sort of like a midlife crisis type thing, but I missed that energy. That aliveness that I had when I was in Vietnam, that anything was possible, and just just a feeling of newness, and being exposed to, I don't know, different ideas, different culture. It was the best time of my life. I mean, I had a love-hate relationship with Vietnam then because there were obviously frustrating elements. And when you're young in your career, you're worried, like, is this going to keep me? Is this going to hold me? Am I not going to be able to integrate back in? Everybody else is like moving up a trajectory. I think that's also different now for young people, but it was a concern, and it is difficult to adjust coming back.
Yeah, you and I kind of share this. We both went to good schools. We went out and we made some money, and then you're just like something inside of us is just like this doesn't feel right. And then you're like, go to the money or go to poverty. It's like it's really the extremes, right? Stay in business for 20 years or whatever, and go into the arts, and what is that need to bring out that creative energy that we just can't, like, we can't hold back.
I mean, I for me, I think everybody's creative. I think everybody has a different
Yeah.
channel and outlet. I think that's part of why we're here, for people to figure out what that is for them. But to me, it's like the whole point of life, right? I mean, I know that I'm most satisfied in life. Even in my job, I do some writing, and I'm most satisfied in that part of my job, for example, just when I have a few hours and I can just look at a report or get feedback, get somebody edits it. I get excited. I don't care how many edits they are, because it's like what you were talking about with the translations, that you improve, because then you're like, wow, that's a good point. Or, when somebody has fresh eyes on it. But I think creativity is everything. That it's what creates meaning, gives life meaning, right? I mean, even with this book, when I were, because people ask like a lot of questions, this is kind of the same questions about the book, but I see for myself that this book, the My Vietnam, Your Vietnam book, it really, for me, filled a hole, like a big gap in the relationship with my father. And somehow I needed closure with that. I needed reconciliation, for lack of a better word. I needed to make something beautiful out of something that in a lot of ways was quite painful, like growing up with a wonderful man, but a distant father emotionally. I had to make sense of that. So this book was a way for me to kind of put it all together and make an offering. Maybe it affects somebody else. And then it does feel healed in a way to me. It does feel resolved. I feel like it's a gift to him. I don't think he feels the same way. I think he thinks of it more as his gift for me, because I wanted to do it, which is partly true. But I also think a lot more people are going to read his story because of that book, because of the way it's interwoven.
And we're going to get into that.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phat. How it was put together. Before we do that, I've read several pieces, editorial pieces that you've written. And I've always wanted to know how does that happen? What's the process of like, and I'm asking out loud. I know some of the basics, but I'm asking out loud because I think it's important for people in this audience to know that whatever we're feeling as Vietnamese Americans, and we want to put it out there into the mainstream, there's kind of this way of doing it. Because I've seen Erin Steinhauer from Vietnam Society. She's written pieces. You've written pieces. Can you tell us about how that sort of works, right? You want to write something and you want to send it in as an editorial. How does that all work?
I think, well, what I'm starting to, it's writing, there's the art of writing, let's say a big project, but I always feel it does really help to have like smaller pieces out in the world and kind of building that name for yourself. And to me, it's a lot about like, you always have to try, you have to keep trying, you have to keep pushing. But if I think knowing people, knowing editors, having people who are familiar with your work, like even through my small press, like they've helped me. I have a few pieces coming out, one in Lit Hub and one on Writer's Digest, and they helped with that to sort of facilitate, because they were promoting the book, and then the editors asked like, oh, can she write something about this book? That's wonderful, like not having to pitch. But mostly you have to have the idea, you have to pitch it, you have to find the editor's information. A lot of this information is consolidated. There's one woman, there's an email I get every week that this woman consolidates all like open pitches that she finds on Twitter or X, and then sends out a weekly email about it.
Wow.
Yeah, and a lot of it's not relevant, but every once in a while you'll find something that is. But yes, I think that that's an important part that I'm still building of one's writing career, because you the little pieces bring people to your bigger works, unless, not all of us can be Viet, like there's only one Viet in our community. The rest of us, I think, continue, like have to keep pushing our work out there. And it to me, it's important, because every time I do that, the response, just and somebody pointed out to me recently, it's like I think for me that's another reason why I write. It's to connect. It's because there have been holes, a lot of holes in my life, and it's like, where do you fill that hole? And then you share something, and then somebody else is like, oh, I feel the same. Or, you summarized what I was trying to articulate. Or it also causes some weird things where people feel that it's can be feel one-sided, because then they read something intimate of yours and they feel that they know you really well. And yes, they've read it, but that doesn't mean you're friends. I don't know. You know what I mean?
I do know. I want to go back to that comment you said. There's only one Viet. Why is there only one Viet?
Well, I mean, there's only one one person I feel in our community that has reached that level.
But
Yes.
do you think that there, I of course there's room for more, right? Obviously, but I want to get into the mechanics of why this is happening. Is it because his writing is truly so phenomenal that that room at the top for that one person, but if there's another writer who has the mind of what he's, because he's a very obviously very good writer and he's just a very brilliant guy, but are there more of us out there that are writing at that level? Is that level achievable, I think, for the literary community in the Vietnamese American diaspora?
I think there has to be like a I think Viet was wonderful. I think he opened up because of his success. I do think it has opened up so many doors for so many other people. So I, you know, and all of his work also with DVAM and supporting the community. I think, you know, you have to reach, he's a brilliant writer, he's a brilliant man, he's a great speaker, right? He's not only a writer, but he's representing a voice, and everybody might not agree what of that voice, and that's fine, right? But he's representing something, and his everything that he's done, it he kind of he's just like it's like a confluence of factors, right? A book that can have that can be made into a series that's interesting enough. Not every book, it's not possible with every book to make it into a series, right? Even if it's great writing. But also just I think his like all the themes that he thinks about and talks about, I think they're very relevant. They're very important. I don't know any other, do you know any other Vietnamese author that's
Oh my God, that th
as,
those are fighting words because I've had so many authors on, you know.
well, I mean, they're all great in their ways, but do you see what I'm saying? It's like, it has to be a confluence of like an external factor of what, of the country, the world, like what piques interest, what can have broader appeal.
Yeah,
And
I'm just trying to break down what has he, how is it that he's gotten to that level? And we know I can analyze it, you know, but can other people learn from our conversation? Like, this is kind of where you need to be. This is kind of how you need to be thinking about things.
but I don't think we, I don't think, I think every artist and creative person has like a different path and a different place, right? Like my writing is not at all like Viet's. Like I write from a very personal perspective. I mean, even in comparison with my father, all of his stuff is sort of history heavy in the book, but for my lens is always the personal. It's, you know, that's why I like memoir and nonfiction. Like I like to share personal experiences that will then, you know, maybe connect with people. My path is different, right? But then if you have, but if you can, because I'm not like building on some theme that is, that can be a broad topic of discussion, for example. Whereas just talking about Vietnamese identity, you know, being a refugee, all the, it's just, it be, I don't know. I think he just became important in a very, like a the right moment of our history.
But
And
I
some authors that happens, like there's Tommy Orange, he's a native author. I don't know if you've ever heard of. He was also nominated for a Pulitzer, and I just read his book There There. And when I read his work, I'm just like, wow, I think he's gonna be, in my head, I thought he's like the Viet for the native, that in my opinion, I don't know. But that's what I felt. I felt like this person, his, because I think he grew up in New Mexico and then also and spent a lot of time in Oakland, like just what he thinks about, like what he writes about, it's culturally relevant. And he was nominated for a Pulitzer, you know, and I hope he wins one day. But I thought he might be this voice for the, and I think the writer has to care to speak politically. Yeah, I think that make
makes a big difference too.
yeah.
But you can only speak politically if you're so aware of a lot of factors that are happening in the world. And I think
Yes.
that broad spectrum of his scholarly knowledge is
Yes.
really what allows him the, you know, the mobility to really write about the things that he's writing. Because then once you have like contextualized the things that are happening historically, you can really drill down on how it's relevant for your people.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, like
Exactly.
I
Yeah.
said, so now we're gonna get into your writing process, your Vietnam, my Vietnam, the whole way that this book has been put together. All right, let's start that it is a, I don't know if you can really call it a dual memoir. Is it a dual memoir, or is it two separate memoirs that you brought together to, because you guys weren't writing in conjunction with each other. You're
Yes.
really taking your father's sort of historical perspective and kind of like bringing it in, editing it, bringing it into your story.
Yes. I mean, I think there's no other word. I mean, I think in that way it still is, but that's definitely correct about the process, but I think we don't really have another word for
Yeah.
like two separate stories. So technically I think it's still a dual memoir, but no, definitely the process was much more me, bringing his story. He definitely wrote all of his parts and I wrote all of my parts and I edited his work and I shaped it so that it created a cohesive narrative, but we weren't sort of, yeah, we weren't, I don't even know how that actual process of like two people writing something together would work. I think to me, this is the only way I can imagine it. Two people, like let's say you and I were writing about Vietnam, I'd be like, okay, Kenneth, you go do your part, I'll do my part. Then
Yeah.
we'll see what happens, or we'll talk in the beginning. What themes are we going to cover? And I kind of did all that work, like what are the themes? I'm really proud of the it, weaving together. That is like actually what I'm most proud of in the book because I knew my parts kind of lacked this gravitas, I would say, just the weight of history, right? Because it literally was about the times when I was in my 20s, and I actually moved to Vietnam three different times. So I wrote about the first time, the second time, the third time, and also coming back to the States and having some experiences with the Vietnamese American community. And for my dad's, it was his coming to the States, but also like growing up in Vietnam, and then building a life here. So it kind of covers not just Vietnam, but a lot.
And when you, let me make a quick left turn here, because I just popped in my mind, when you pitch it to publishers or in the early days when you're trying to explain this, how did the publishing community accept it?
I mean, I think I had a lot of interest actually from like academic presses, but a lot of them actually didn't want di turned it down. Like they would, with a couple places they got to like the editorial board, but then they didn't want to publish it because they felt it was more commercial. They loved the concept, and I think it would fit to me naturally with an academic press, but they felt they wouldn't be able to give as much press as, a more traditional press. I knew that this. I always believe in the idea, and that's why I was able to publish it quickly because it hasn't really been done. I mean, I think in our community, Len Cao, I think Len Cao wrote something with her daughter, but that was more, I don't know, I don't think it wasn't Vietnam necessarily related, but just more mother-daughter. And then I think that what is that Panda? There was a young adult novel that I want to read.
My
Yeah,
father, Panda Killer,
that I feel like
Jimmy Joe Bond.
yes. Have you read that book?
Yeah, she's been on the podcast.
Yeah, I really want to read it because I think that kind of is similar in a way, even though it's fiction, but a father-daughter sort of kind
It's
of.
father daughter, but she's the sole writer, and she inserts
Okay.
her father's story, just like interchanging the chapters. Like every
Yes.
she alternates the chapters with her father's story. So it's not like. It's not in the structure of your writing, but
And I mean, my dad is actually a really great writer in English. Like he. That's what's I think a Vietnamese man of his generation writing so much all in English, like that's what I find like so beautiful about his writing. And also just when you read it, I mean he is very emotional and passionate. Doesn't feel that way when you actually talk to him, but in his writing it does come through, just all of the not super emotional. I would say emotional in the sense of just being aware of the impact of death and war and, loss.
Yeah. This is a topic in itself. This idea that they have, it's so normal and basic, but this idea of them having their own lives before we came into the mix, it's hard to comprehend, right? I remember growing up and being really upset at people who were so anti-Vietnam, the previous generation, anti-government, anti-Vietnam, anti-everything. And I never had any context of what they went through. And you would hear about it at the dinner table, right? And you would hear the stories of the atrocities that happened to them. And even to this day, I still can't connect with their deep feelings about the hate, the hurt, all of the emotions that are coming, you know, from these people. And now that I'm interviewing more people in their 90s and their 80s, and you know, you're sitting with your father, I realize that it is impossible for us to ever fully get the scope of what they went through.
Yes, unless we went, no, there's no way.
No way.
And we might be the same way. Like that's a, it's a lot to go through. It's a lot to see, like even from my father, see, to be in high school and to see a friend being taken
Yeah.
away, or, but they visited one friend. He didn't have like his ID card, so he was taken away. And then they visited him at this like camp and talked to him behind, the barbed wire, but the kid had already given up. Their friend, they were like, tell them that you still have to take, the back two or something, one of the high school equivalency tests. It's just like he said, tell them that you are on your way to do that and maybe they'll let you out. But his friend had already given up hope and just said no. And then eventually, I think probably a few years later died. And it's, and also like as my father, like just being a doctor in the South Vietnamese Army, I mean, you had, so probably like they just had to shut this emotional cord as it links to like seeing death and destruction and lives of people that you care about. I mean, imagine going back to a re-education camp.
Yeah.
I mean, being in a, just, we can't even imagine. So yes, that's why I do think, like I put in my book, like I thought when my dad, it was interesting because right before I left for Vietnam, we were at a bookstore and he gave me this book. That it's called The House on Dream Street, and it's written by a white American who went to move to Hanoi, Dana Sachs, before, like in the 90s. And he bought that and he said, oh, this might be interesting for you. And I was really offended because I'm like, is that what he thinks of me? Does he think that I'm just, that I'm not at all Vietnamese? Like, does he associate me more with this like white American from the South who went back to Hanoi? Is that what he thinks I am? Just that, like not really Vietnamese. And I wasn't really Vietnamese at the time. I mean, and that's also part his fault. Like he didn't instill culture in us, I think, as a way to protect us.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. It's a surviving mechanism. You
Yeah.
don't want your kids to be bullied or, you know, stand out too much.
And I look at him now, like he's probably the age, well, just some childhood memories. He's probably around my age. Like he was probably in his 40s, like when I have all these childhood memories. And I just remember being so frustrated, like, why can't, he was a doctor, but like we would always go over to the Chinese doctor's house or the other Asian doctor. And I'm like, why can't my dad just be friends with like white people too? Like, why doesn't he have any white friends? Like, why does it all, like, we have to just do these like Asian things? And we were always in towns that didn't have a large Asian population. But now, like, I'm also the same. I feel so much more comfortable in New Mexico with Asian Americans. Like, and I wasn't always that way. But now I'm like, here I am, like, growing into my dad ways.
Yeah, the stories that I'm hearing from, you know, these older men about the years that they were younger in the 50s, you know, the preparation of building sort of strategic alliances and grooming soldiers to fight back the invasion of the North. You know, it's bone chilling to kind of listen to these accounts. And, you know, the more you listen to them, the more you empathize with their stories. But at the same time, I'm like, man, that sucked. But that's not the way I see the world, right? And I'm a staunch believer in, like, I see the world a certain way. I should be allowed to see this world a certain way. And then they should be allowed to see the world in a certain way. But don't ever cross my line and say that I cannot do what I want with bridging Vietnam,
Yes.
the diaspora, like, because I think that's my, you know, my life. I want to be able to freely communicate, go back and forth, and when I run into trouble, I know it's, you know, it's, you'll run into trouble everywhere, you know, whether it's in the U.S. government or the Vietnamese government or wherever in the world where you're like fucking with other people's like livelihood or their deal, right? You're fucking with their organization, we'll get in trouble. So it's like we have to just always be kind of like cognizant of like the bigger powers that are watching. And but at the level that I'm playing at right now, it's, you know, just I'm just having dialogue with people who are like you and me, you know?
Yes. And to me, like, that's where I mean, like, what you're saying, what you just said, like, that's kind of why I love the title of this book, My Vietnam, Your Vietnam, because I feel like it's
Yes.
relevant to all of us. Like, it's even relevant to you and I. Like, you have your Vietnam, I have my Vietnam. We might be of the same generation, but we still have different perspectives of Vietnam and what Vietnam means to us, even if we're people who both, you know, gone back and forth. And that's why it's like, I think for me, and my dad does get this, which is why I appreciate him, that he kind of let me have my Vietnam, even if he disagreed, right? He just didn't really say. And somebody wrote a review that I really loved because it said that this book was about, like, shows like the pain of intergenerational trauma, the power of healing, but the fact that two divergent perspectives can exist at once. And that's what I believe is the essence of this book and why it's important, because of exactly that. Like, we just all have our different perspectives. And it's important for each of us to be able to articulate that and have other people's, like, maybe they don't agree, but that doesn't mean your truth is not valid. We have to, and that's partly why we have so much conflict, because people just want to only see what they see, but that's actually just their reality. That isn't a universal truth, right? I could say, I have a great time in Vietnam. I love going there. I love going to eat. I love having coffee. I love the food. I love my experience with people. I loved my former colleagues there. I still have great friends there. I believe these people really care about me. Somebody else could be like, oh, they just want, you know, like an older person. They just want something from you. I'm like, no, I legitimately believe these people are my friends. And many of them are Hanoians. But, you know, that doesn't mean, you know, it's just like, yeah, that's all that's true, right? Like, when I worked in Hanoi, because I went back the second time and worked in Hanoi, I worked for UNICEF, like, I really felt like I became an adult in Vietnam, in the sense that sense of, like, being with community and care. Like, my colleagues would be like, oh, if I was sick one day, do you want me to bring you something? They would text me, like, do you want me to bring you some food? In the States, nobody, your colleague would not do that.
And that's the thing. I think at the end of the day, there's human behaviors happening everywhere, whether it's in Vietnam or the US, and there's just different cultural aspects, like what you're saying, like workers in, you know, your colleagues here in America, it's they don't do that.
No, they'd be like, feel better. They might. I mean, we sent my team sent, you know, our boss, like, she's having surgery. We sent her a gift, but we're not offering to show up at her house
Yeah, yeah.
like with homemade soup. Like, we're like, here's a gift card to order your food. Here's some flowers. Like, it's not that the thought isn't there, but to me, I felt like in Vietnam, these people knew she's a young woman. She's by herself. She doesn't have family here. What I felt they did is like, how can we then help her feel like she has family here? And I don't think, not that I don't have great friends here or people who love me, but I don't think that thought goes through any of their heads.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
you know, like, how can we fill a gap in her sense of, because that family unit is so strong. It's like, she doesn't have that. So how do we help her?
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam.
Like,
You know, and I think that conversation, what you just said about like our parents' generation, they're like, well, they're trying to extract something from you, you know, they're trying to get something. Well, that might be true 30 years ago, right?
yeah.
Be true 30 years, 20 years ago, maybe, maybe. But today, That's like the farthest from the truth, because many of the people that we're dealing with in Vietnam at our level, which is like, they're sophisticated, they're educated, they're people that we can have conversations with because we're Americans and we're not like fully ingrained in Vietnamese society. But so the people that we're dealing with are people who are, they have a lot of Western sensibilities. They're do it probably financially doing way better than we are.
No
I
problem.
that's what I wanted to get to,
I agree.
right?
Probably.
They're
Well, because
probably
look,
been to
I
more
know.
countries than we have. They've been more traveled than we have. They just have more experience. A lot of the people that we deal with, they're just like, there's not, what I'm trying to say, there's nothing to extract. There's nothing that they're going to get from us. Nothing.
No, and even for me, like when I went back and worked at UNICEF, it was as like a it was a good position, it was a good salary at that time, but like there was a Vietnamese, I had like a Vietnamese counterpart, like a program manager, same level, and I'm like, oh my God, this woman is so much more talented than me, and yet I'm, because I'm American, I get paid like, I don't know how much more, a lot more, but she also, we both had graduate degrees from the UK. I did not do not speak Vietnamese fluently. She speaks Vietnamese fluently and English fluently. You know what I mean? And I'm just like, and then you want to pay me more? Like, and how does somebody, this is why I actually left international development, because I found it so contradictory. I thought there's actually nothing I can do for the country. I don't have enough knowledge unless that was my, I did my, PhD on, the development of Vietnam and studied the intricate nature of the development of that country and could legitimately, intellectually, and programmatically contribute. But I did not have that background. I did not feel like it was just, it was, there's so many contradictions in that. Like, I didn't feel it wasn't worthy. It was not, but I felt like there were other people that deserved that more than me, right? That deserved.
And I think a lot of us, go back with a savior complex too. We're gonna go back and save Vietnam. And I'm like, yes, there's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of like really messed up. You could see it, right? But at the same time, this whole like going back to help Vietnam, it's
No, I think it's actually to help ourselves. And that's when like some Vietnamese people would meet me and they would just say like, you're so American, because I do, because that's true, right? And I was young and naive, and I think that is a very American perspective. Like, oh, I'm gonna come over here. Like, I met this very talented designer. I loved her. She became a really good friend, and she was one person that said that to me, because she had these great designs for like little t cube tables, lacquer, colorful, and she was just like, oh my God, you're so American. Because I was like, oh, you can sell these. She could have, she did. I mean, she had a business, but she doesn't need to hear that from me. She doesn't need to hear that from like a 20 something Vietnamese American that has never run a design business before. So I think we go back because it fills the gaps in our soul. Like, it's actually, they're helping and contributing to our development, not the other way around.
Yeah, the best way, I think, when you're first going back to Vietnam as a Vietnamese American person from the diaspora, if it's your first time and you're of age where you can think in your 20s and 30s and 40s and you're going back to the first time, I think that the best thing to do is to go back without any preconceived notions that came from the previous generation, your own mind, wipe it all clean. You go back, and even if it's your third trip back, listen and try to kind of absorb what is going on the ground there. Because I think, all of us go back, in their early days thinking that we can help the country, and that's like not that can't be applicable to Vietnam today because
No.
such a different place now.
I think only people in the country can help the country.
It's true. And so that brings us to the premiere of the Sympathizer. I've been wanting to kind of bring this into the conversation because you brought it up in our we were just talking before we got on the podcast that you asked me how it went. And I think about where we are today culturally. People like you and I, we're born here, and we've experienced this cultural shift, and it makes me very, very proud to be Vietnamese when you're on a Hollywood, production, a studio lot like Paramount Studios,
Yes.
where this was going on. And, now we can, millions of Vietnamese people around the world are seeing, this wonderful event take place in the mainstream. It was absolutely incredible to witness.
I know it looked amazing. I mean, just and to see all the people there, and then you see, it's special. It's something to celebrate. I keep bringing up in conversation to my non-Vietnamese friends whenever we talk about, if my book comes up, and then I just say it's a great moment for our community. And again, thanks to Vietnamese, we have to give
Win,
them,
yeah. But
it's
that being said, you triggered a sort of response to me when you asked me that question earlier before before we started the podcast. You kind of made me think about, and I want to ask you this while I'm having this comment. I want to ask you, like, I don't feel like my mental state of when I started the podcast to today, it shifted a lot. It's not the same anymore. Our jobs is not, it doesn't feel like our job is like, it's not about like fighting for this sort of space to be represented as much as now. I think the bar is like getting to quality, to a place where we're pumping out a lot more, pieces. Our creative groups are getting more pieces out there. And how do we get quality up? How do we get quantity up? And how do we just really put ourselves on the map, just like the
do you think just like the what?
Koreans?
What about Mai? Have you seen that movie?
Yeah, we can get into that. Have you
I
watched?
haven't seen it. I
Oh.
want to. Is it great?
Well, oh my God, I wish you did watch it, because it's an in-depth conversation that can take, I can really get into this with you, this idea of my.
I really want to, I mean, but it's only playing it, which is so frustrating to me because
Yeah.
it's only playing at 3:45. I'm like, I can't go to see a movie in the middle of the day.
Yeah,
I
but
almost went last weekend,
you
but
got to
I
go.
think.
You got to figure out a way to go. And you got to figure out a way to go, because it's a conversation that you and I can, and you can have with a lot of people, because this piece, Chang Tan, is definitely one of the mile markers for me in the turn of the commercialization of Vietnamese film,
Oh, okay.
turning point. He okay, because I was in distribution and finance for many years, and I brought in maybe six films from Vietnam, but I think we were too early. I started a company with a few filmmakers called Wave Releasing. And I brought in six films. I would venture to say, like, we never broke 200 grand at the box office. We tried, we tried, we tried. And it's very difficult. It was very difficult 10, 15 years ago to, I think it was the quality of the movies, it was the quality of the stories, it was the, maybe the thinking of Vietnamese American diaspora, they were just like, they were just not bought, they were not sold on the fact that Vietnamese films from Vietnam can come to America and be part of AMC or Regal system, right? But that's what I was doing, and it didn't work. And that's six films in. 200,000 was like the top, right? Now, then you get Chang Tan's first film, Bo Ya. He does, I think, about $1 million at the box office, or some crazy number. That's insane. But if you take it back to Vietnam, Bo Ya, I think, made 17 million at the box office, where the highest
Wow.
gross was like 10 million. He just tramples over everybody's numbers. He's like the king. So that happens. And then he did Nha Ba Nu, which is the second film of that trilogy. That did 20 something million as well. And then it did another million here at the box office in the US. Then the third movie, which is Mai, has now done 2 million in the US. This is going to be
I
impossible
love it.
to break for any Vietnamese filmmakers around the world to get. I mean, it's very difficult to get to those numbers in a pure Vietnamese language film. $2 million in the US box office, that's, it's, an
What
obvious
about in Vietnam? Isn't it the highest grossing?
highest grossing Vietnam. I think they're, I don't know. I'm guessing it's over 25 million.
Yeah, I can't wait. I have to go. Maybe I can go
So
figure out.
it's relevant. Okay, so that's the commercial side. That's the business. That's the number side. But let me talk about the relevance in the cultural side of what
But
he's.
also to that point, it's like that's why maybe there are only like that's why going back to saying like, oh, there's only one V, maybe there's only one this guy too, right? And that's okay. That's
There's only
okay to
one Jung Tan.
because they open doors for others that then and then they do help set that bar to raise the standards
Yeah.
to see what's possible. There's probably a little kid growing up like watching Viet, like, oh my gosh, this is now possible for me.
Totally, totally.
Watching these filmmakers, like
But I'll really analyze, I think, why his films are successful, Jung Tan, because I think that he is able to connect deeply with Vietnamese psychology, understanding of what makes tension and drama happen in country, specifically with Vietnamese culture. And that Vietnamese culture that he's talking about all the time is universal. So we in the diaspora can see the entertaining value of the cultural tension that he's putting on screen all the time. You could feel it. But now, like with our sensibilities as Americans, it's hard for like American-born people to see that those films and go, oh, you know, it's I don't know if the word cheesy is a description that I've heard, but it connect with American-born, you know, Vietnamese people. But I know that the students that are coming from international studies, Du Học, coming to the United States, and they came when they were 15, and they're here in their like 20s now, and they enjoy that film. They enjoy those films because there's a universality that you can connect with in the subject matter, because it's all family drama. Family drama, neighborhood drama. It's nothing global. It's nothing like 30,000 feet up, you know,
But
drama.
that's very Vietnamese to me,
Yeah.
right? Family drama. I mean,
Family drama. And it's very.
and then it's interesting because I think like when Amanda Nguyen, when that was announced that she was going to space, I think I somewhere I heard that there were like all these comments of people saying, "Oh, she's not really Vietnamese," or like maybe pe like people like us, like maybe people have problems with that, like us claim like we're Vietnamese American technically, right? But then maybe some people might feel we're claiming Vietnamese-ness that's maybe beyond. I have a friend who grew up in Singapore, and she, whenever we meet with Asian Americans, she'll say like, "But are you guys really Asian?" And I'm like, "Well, I guess that's a good point. I mean, we're Asian American
That's a
because I
point.
think,
Yeah. Fair
yeah."
point. Fair point.
But
It's debatable.
I think you're bringing up interesting points in that we're at a different, we are at a completely different moment in where the Vietnamese
Yes.
creative American, let's say Vietnamese American creative community is, and what things like the Sympathizer do is they do open up, and we don't we're not remember the time when our books were only about being a boat person, like, or we had one Andrew Pham going back, Catfish and the Mandela, like, but not it was primarily the older generation writing about coming to Vietnam. Now we have all kinds of different stories are, and that actually, like a Vietnamese artist friend of mine, who's also he's a poet, he told me never to not put the Vietnamese book out first because I would be pigeonholed as just someone who could write about Vietnam. I actually don't think this, he might have said to me a decade ago, I don't think that's true anymore for Vietnamese, for our community. I didn't. I mean, my first book was because I'm very interested in like women's issues, what topics related to women and identity. And that book was more about that and my mom and like turning 40 and these things. So the Vietnam book is second, but I don't think anyone would think she can only write about
Right.
Vietnam. And
Right.
that's progress,
That
you
is
see?
progress. Yeah, that's evolution.
Yes. And us not having, even if older generation won't see that, us not having their trauma of going back is also evolution. It's also healing. It is reconciliation for, like, we talked about this with my dad. It's like, that's an individual thing, what reconciliation means. But to me, that's a huge sign of reconciliation. The fact that our generation, younger generations, can go back, want to go back, feel some sort of connection.
You know, I agree with you when you say, you know, we're at a different place today, and it is exciting because we don't know what's on the other side of like today, you know?
No.
What is on the other side of today? Because it's not the same. The paradigm has shifted. It's not shifting, it is like shifted.
Because there's so many. I mean, I feel like I always learn about a new Vietnamese author that I didn't know about before, right? I'm just like, oh, there's another one coming out with a novel. There's this, there's that, and there's this movie. There was another movie recently too that I didn't see that was playing here. Which
Fragile
one?
Flower.
No, there was another one. Vietnamese director. I think it was his first one. Went through the country. I don't know. I can't remember. It was playing in Santa Fe, like a, but yeah, that one, and even the Taste of Things, that he's French Vietnamese, you know. That and his work is beautiful, I think. Taste of Things would be, I mean, it's not a Vietnamese film, but he is a Vietnamese French director. It was, yeah.
Chen En Hung. Yeah, he's been
So.
the world, the film world, from the beginning, you know. And
So yes, it's shifted. It's
shifted.
shifted.
It shifted, and it's an exciting time right now to be Vietnamese for sure.
Right. I know I was with somebody, actually a former landlord, and she lives in California, and she was like, oh, I went to she, her daughter's best friend is Vietnamese, and she's like, I went to another book. She's like, oh, I'm coming to yours in San Francisco next week, but I went to another one in San Francisco recently, and I said, Susan Liu, and she said, how did you know? And I said, they're not that many of them. I mean, there are more and more, but you know, you just tell me reading in San Francisco, I can guess who is there. I know who's
Exactly.
like, we know each other, and I think that that's beautiful. I don't know. Do you know of any other creative community that's similar to ours?
I'm not plugged in, but I often think about that question. You know,
I
I
don't think that there are.
because you don't see it with like the Taiwanese community, the Thai community, the Filipino community. I don't know, but I'm not plugged in those, you know, and I think about our communities, and our communities are very, our Vietnamese artist communities are very tight, and especially the film business. Like everybody in the film business knows each other. Like it's a very tight network of Vietnamese filmmakers and people that work in film. And I'm seeing it in the literary world as well. Everybody knows
Yeah.
it.
Yeah, I think it's different. I mean, I have, you know, some friends who are like I don't see the same sort of thing in their communities, like Korean American
You're right.
writers, you know, there are different writing groups that and just writing communities, but it's not the same as this because it's almost like it's like somebody could do a research project on it because I think it mirrors how like
We are
Vietnamese people sort of how we operate in general,
exactly.
right? Like there's always kind of this like, oh, like you know how I don't know, there's always kind of this tension, but there's also beneath the tension always support. Like even if people are like, oh, that person's doing really well or this or that, like there's that which exists always. But then beyond that, there's like, but I would still support that person, you know, I would still make an effort to do what I can for that person.
Because it's our virtual village. It's a virtual village that I think that we are somehow naturally plugged into. And I've been told throughout the last few years, non-Vietnamese people will come up to me and go, you know, like your guys in the film industry, you're all of your teams are the most cohesive I've seen, you know, in all over this industry. And it's true. It's very true. And you know, there's, you know, different levels of filmmakers, but at the end of the day, like they all want to see the next guy elevate the brand. That's what it is. Everybody wants to see the next guy elevate the brand. And it's, there's no like, you don't badmouth like projects. You don't like put down
See,
projects in public. You don't do that. It's like a code almost, you know?
I think it exists across our community. It is a co like even you know Phan Nguyen, who the author of the Bronze Drone. Well, I was invited to do to this Unbound Book Festival, and Phan Nguyen wrote to me, but I thought it was just a Vietnamese. I didn't even realize it was him because he sent me this form. The first thing was a form email. It wasn't like, hi, I'm from, you know, I wrote the author. It was just like, hi, we would like to invite you to participate in the Unbound, you know, very formulaic. And it literally wasn't until like last week that I realized who he was. And I was like, wait a second. I'm so sorry. I didn't know. But it's just like, I don't know. This is what I think is like beautiful, but I just think there's so many beautiful elements of our community. And like Khoi Mai was supposed to be there, but she can't because she had to go back to Vietnam. But
Yeah.
like even Khoi, I mean, she's such an example to me and for I think all Vietnamese writers as well. Like she's so
Generous.
wonderful.
She's
Oh, generous, gracious, kind, like just such an example.
Yeah, she is
I
a special human being. She's very generous with her, with her giving of time and connecting and offering. And, she's just a brilliant and dynamic writer as well.
Yeah, and we and she yeah, it's just it's we have these amazing people that are at the, if you look at like Viet and her, it's just and I think I don't know, it's just it's beautiful to me. I think it I
Well,
don't think it exists in other communities.
I don't think it exists, and I think you're right, because I think if we th like if we think about the reasons why this is happening, I think maybe you think back 50 years ago, this family had a major fight, right? This Vietnamese family had a big fight in their house, and everybody like ran, to the winds, right? They just dispersed. Everybody just like, okay, the family just like had a big fight 50 years ago. And I think the people who survived that fight, the family members who are like, went through that fight, and the kids that knew of this like once big family at one point in time. And I think all the people, the descendants that are like related to this family is like, wait a minute. We are survivors of that family, and we want to make the family name a beautiful thing again in the world. And we're out here trying to legitimize the family name. We're all trying to prove the family name is like a gold, it's a golden thing. And so all of us are in this family, this brand of Vietnamese people all around the world after this big family fight 50 years ago. Now we're just like, how do we make our family come together? I mean, I'm just thinking about this right now because you're asking me.
Oh yeah, it's beautiful what you're saying though. Yes. Like it's a great like children's story. Like I can imagine it being
Right.
taught kind of in that way.
Oh,
To,
wow.
yeah, that's what you just 'cause that's a beautiful story, whatever that what you're just saying.
Yeah,
And I can
because
see it.
we're talking about why we're so there's so much cohesion
Cohesive.
in the Vietnamese creative community. I don't know about the business community. I don't know about the finance or, crypto community. I don't know those communities well, but I just know the creative communities are really tight. Literature, film, they're just really tight. And I think it's because we're on the like the front end. We're the front lines of spit shining and polishing that family plaque, right?
Yeah.
That's what we're doing. And we just want to make the family name just like everywhere in the world, they're like, oh, the Vietnamese family name is that's the tribe that you want to aspire to become, because they're just close, they love each other, they're supportive, they had a big family fight 50 years ago, but everybody's like, trying their best. And then there's infighting, of course, and like every
Yes,
family,
there's always inside.
infighting, there's dysfunction, but at the same time, we have a lot of love for each other.
No, I when you say that, I just think of like a zillion. I can think of so many examples of that for me in my life, and also in like because my mom passed away, my dad was kind of distant. Like there, like I spoke to you earlier, there are always these holes, and now it's like with this book, I feel like the hole is being filled with the Vietnamese community, right? Like
Yeah.
so many people came to me and like, do you want to do this? Can I perform with you? Can I sing? A singer songwriter friend, half Vietnamese, like, can I come with you? Can we do this together? Tracy with the Vietnamese boat people. Can we, can we name the stories? And it's just beautiful to me.
Yeah.
It's, and I genuinely, there's a Vietnamese librarian at Santa Ana Library who I love. And I had a meeting with him because I would have an event there and I just laughed for an hour. I'm like, this man, I don't know. He was just so funny. He was just very animated, very Vietnamese. And I was like, he's like a show and it's just, he's great.
When is that in Santa
The
Ana?
18th, I think, May 18th.
May 18th?
Yeah, but I'll be there for the Viet Book Festival too. I think that's the 5th.
Okay.
I don't know. That is one thing I don't like to do, actually, like talking. I mean, I don't mind talking to you because it's one-on-one, but speaking in a in front of people about your book is really hard for me. I know some people are great at it.
No
I'm
wonder
not.
you've put so many we've we've had to coordinate so many times with our because you probably subconsciously don't like to talk about the book.
And even friends, like everyone's like, oh, you should be so proud. I'm so proud of you. This is wonderful. Like, these are not bad. You know, nobody's saying, like, people are being supportive, but there's something in me that's like, well, how do you then, you know, distill like so much emotion into an hour and like package it so that technically somebody wants to buy the book? I'm just kind of like, I know in the Santa Fe event, my dad is coming and I'm actually going to read. I'm not going to tell him. He might be really pissed at me after. I'm going to speak. I'm going to write something for him as if I would read that at his death. And I'm going to read it in front of him. Because the moments in my life when he's actually, when I've heard him speak in public, I was like blown away. But my mom's funeral, his mom's, my grandmother's funeral, the anniversary, reunion of his medical school class in Northern Virginia, like I was so moved. And so I thought, obviously, like when he dies, if I sh say something, he's not going to be there. So I'm going to do that.
Are you going to frame it like it's a eulogy?
No, I'm not. I'm good, but I'm just going to say that there were so many things I wasn't able to tell my mom. And because of the nature of the relationship with my dad, there's so many things I didn't tell my dad. And these are the things that I want to say, mostly just how grateful I am for what the foundation he set for us and how he was managing so many things. And even though he was quiet, like there's a beauty in that, right? Because some people like, feel they have to say something about everything. And you're like, why? But he sees most things and just sometimes he needed to interject more, I felt, as like in, with discipline with my sister and I probably, but yeah, I'm gonna say something beautiful. I think people will cry in that. I feel that. I will cry.
Well, please share that with us, and I'd love to see the video of that and, watch that. Please get that recorded.
I hope, I don't know if it's a library thing that people, libraries can't
Or
record,
have a
but
friend. Have a friend
oh
record.
yeah. Okay.
Have a
I'll have a
friend
friend.
record. How can we buy the book?
Oh, it's released on Tuesday. I mean, all the online, the normal online bookshop,
Amazon.
Amazon, some booksellers, I don't know which one will have it, but
My
yeah.
Vietnam, Your Vietnam
Yes.
by Christina Bo. I know you're like, oh, I'm so cringy to promote my own book, but
I know, right?
what the hell are we doing here if you're not promoting your book, right?
Yeah. But I also like that about myself, right? Because I'm
Yeah,
kind of like,
totally.
I don't care. I tell my friends that, like, you can buy one, fine. That's great if you want one. I can sign it if you want me to sign it. I also hate signing books. I hate the whole story part of like
I
pushing
know.
everything out.
I feel you, but I think we have to change that. We have to, because I feel the same way. It's hard for me to promote. It's hard for me to be on social media. I go to a lot of events, and my friends say, well, in the early years, like, why don't you post about this stuff? Why you got invited to be on this podcast, that pod? And I'm like, that's just not the way I roll. I'm trying to do it, but it's hard to break that, whatever that, call it insecurity, call it, I don't know what it is. It's just a very uncomfortable thing to promote.
But I think it's okay to not, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like if
But
like
we're never
I'm
going
so
to be.
happy that writing isn't my livelihood. If I had to rely on this, okay, it would be different, right? If,
Oh, okay.
but because it's not my life, like I don't need, it's just an extra thing. It's just for me, it's like I want to put things out there. I have an idea for another book that I want to get out in the next com in the co next couple of years. I mean, I just want to write. I don't really, the whole going to do all these talks. It's like, yeah. Which is also nice to have people like our conversation. I'll try to watch my before the San Jose conversation.
Yeah.
We can talk about my. I think that's going to be a good conversation. But I like things like this,
Yeah,
like
organic.
talking about the book, but we're talking about other things too.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a beauty of like long form podcasting is the ability to kind of like go off on tangents, That's the only way to do it for me is
I know.
get to know Christina if I can't talk about the tangents,
Yeah.
I want to get to know who you are, and I don't want to just be like worrying about what you're saying in the book, that I think it's more interesting to know the broader identity of who you are and what makes you tick. And that goes for every guest that I have.
Yeah.
I want to hear about everything. Well, Christina, thank you so much. We survived this. We did it. We did it. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.